Hey, folks, it's Maximus Mark, and welcome to today's show on raw food. Yes, that's right, raw food. Now, I know what you might be thinking. Raw food, that's not for me. However, consider for a second that maybe, just maybe, there is something that you're missing. Today, I want to separate the facts from the fiction about raw food, and I couldn't think of any better guest to do that than the one I have today. He is one of, if not the world's leading authority on raw food. As you may know or not know, I personally eat a lot of my food raw, or at least next to raw. I mean, I eat raw eggs, cook my meat for about 3.2 seconds on each side. However, I still cook my chicken, turkey, and lightly steam my vegetables. However, today's guest, Adonis Wonderplant, has not only treated and cured himself consuming raw foods, he has treated thousands of patients using these methods. By the way, some of these foods are not just raw, but they're rotten raw foods, which you can read about in his book, We Want to Live. Regardless of whether you agree or disagree with raw food, today you're going to be treated to an insight into raw food that is very rare from Adonis, who has been doing this for 4 decades. Even if there's no way you're ever going to eat raw meat, you'll be definitely going to learn something today that you didn't already know. Adonis' outlook on nutrition is completely different, and in that there is wisdom we can all learn from. So with that said, welcome to the show, Adonis. Are you there?
Well, thank you.
You're most welcome. Yeah, I'll just put up the volume. Yeah, there you go. That's much better. Excellent. So,
terrific.
Would you be able to share with our listeners that your amazing story of how you became the raw food authority that you are today?
Well, I started off being very sick. I was born in a very sickly, violent household, and I just progressively got worse and worse as I got older. And when I got to 12 years old, my third polio vaccine caused diabetes and angina. So I had about 300 heart attacks from the age of 15 and a half to 22. Also, at 18 months old, I received a tetanus shot, the third tetanus shot, that made me autistic. So I had learning disabilities all throughout childhood up to adulthood. And when I hit 19 years old, I developed an ulcer that turned tumorous from medical therapies. And then the medical therapy for that tumor was surgery, and that metastasized and became tumorous of the entire abdominal area, so they radiated it. And that gave me blood and bone cancer. And then they gave me chemotherapy, even though I only had a 1% chance of living, it made me a complete invalid. So I was dying. I was given a few weeks to live after I stopped the chemotherapy. And a volunteer from the hospice, who's a young 8-year-old African American, offered me carrot juice and raw milk. And if you've ever had chemotherapy or radiation poisoning and surgeries all back-to-back, everything you eat tastes like cardboard and or postage stamps. So it was pretty grueling. Everything that I ate was just miserable. And, of course, my diet was the common standard sad American diet. I blended donuts because of the radiation therapy. It also deteriorated the bone around my teeth. So my teeth just sat in my gums and dangled. And if I bit down on my own teeth, I bled profusely up to a half a cup at a time. And I was getting transfusions 1 to 2 a week because of that. So I had to drink everything liquid. So I had my donuts and RC Cola or Sprite all blended together, and that was my diet.
Wow.
And then this young boy offered the raw milk and carrot juice to me, and they tasted wonderful.
Did you say
all cooked processed food tasted horrible?
Did you say that you had 300 heart attacks?
300 heart attacks, yes, between the age of 15 and a half and 22.
How is that possible, 300? That's an awful lot of heart attacks.
Well, because I was autistic, I was not inclined. I was not indoctrinated as most people were, so I was not told it was a bad thing. And also, when they found me passed out, I only passed out about 50 times of that 300. And in the times that I passed out, around people, like at school, of course, I was rushed to the hospital. They could find nothing wrong with the heart. In other words, they were just looking for congenital heart disease or mineralization or some kind of blockage, some kind of congestion in the heart. They couldn't find any. They weren't looking for the medical drugs from the mercury, the liquid mercury, the aluminum, the formaldehyde, the ether, the detergents, all of those compounds that are in vaccines, in that polio vaccine that started it. So they don't look for their cause because, of course, they will be blamed and they could get sued. So they don't look for those kinds of reasons for heart attacks. So they could never find anything wrong, thank God, or else they would have treated me for it.
All right. So in saying that the heart attacks were of a minor variety, they weren't full-blown heart attacks, is that the way they were?
Full-blown heart attacks.
Right.
Yeah. Because I was autistic and not conditioned to be in fear, whenever I had pain, and I had pain all my life, if I lifted my arm for 2 minutes, I had pain, severe pain. So when I had the heart attacks, it was just a matter of relaxing into the pain. Most people fight it. And when you fight a Charlie horse, what happens?
Right, you get more pain.
Worse.
Yeah.
And that's right. What a heart attack is. A heart attack is a Charlie horse in your muscle, the heart muscle.
Right.
And that's what the heart is, 90% muscle.
Okay.
So I was able to pass through it without death, although it was excruciatingly painful. Every time.
Right. Well, let's move on to why we booked the call today. This question is definitely for the listeners out there, but can you tell us, why do you eat your food raw?
Well, it makes me feel better and it tastes great.
Yes.
Scientifically, when you cook foods, you not only destroy, cauterize, and transform all of your nutrients in the food, you create at least 32 known toxins, three of the major which are lipid peroxides, heterocyclic amines, and your lipid peroxides.
Right. I was on a call a little while ago, and I actually had someone on. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but Randy Roach. And he told me a story about...
Oh, yeah.
Sorry? You're
going to... I know Randy.
Yeah, Randy. He said that one time when you went to the toilet, you thought that wasn't food and you extracted it and you found that it actually wasn't food. Your body was detoxing some of the chemotherapy that you had years before. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's like an oil spill. Do you know anything about the Valdez oil spill or any oil spill? They'll clean up maybe 30% of it. And then 70%, the earth has to gradually neutralize those poisons. Well, the body does the same thing. It takes very long, according to Dr. Francis Pottinger and Dr. Howell's work, separately on animals, they found that it took 5 generations, depending upon the animal. 5 generations to detoxify the animal.
Just one second, John. I think you have another call. If we could just want to pause the call. There's a...
I'm in the jungles of Thailand on the out edges of the jungle. So it just may drop once in a while.
Oh, okay, because there's this beeping noise. Oh, it's just gone. I don't know what it was, but yeah, there was definitely a beeping noise. Sorry, continue is what you were saying. The body needs to detoxify itself.
Yeah, so the bodies take a long time to detoxify, and when they detoxify, 90% of the poisons are supposed to leave through the skin. However, we're so sick in our intestine and throughout the skin, jammed in the lymphatic system, that most people don't, so they will dump into the stomach and intestines a lot of poisons. Whenever you vomit or have diarrhea, that's the body dumping those poisons quickly.
Yep.
And I had a patient one time who had cancer, and most cancer patients who are near the end of reversing or at the point where they're completely reversing the cancer have a terrible flu or a vomit and diarrhea spell. And this one particular woman, she wasn't very old, maybe 38 years old, very young to me because I'm nearly 65, and she vomited for 8 weeks. Well, after, that's the longest I've ever seen. The longest I've seen before that was 6 weeks. So I had about 4 ounces or 2 or 4 ounces of her vomit analyzed for poisons and toxicity, not bacteria, like a medical professional always attacks the bacteria, the natural part of your body. But there's always some kind of contaminant, industrial contaminant that causes disease. Whether it's just cooking your food, that's an industrial process. So I sent it off to the lab, and the lab called me 2 days later and said, somebody's poisoning your patient. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, we have to report it anytime we find a level of thallium that's high in the body. We have to report it to the police and to the doctor. And I said, I don't think anything like that is happening. You know, we're poisoning her. She used to be a metallurgist. She made silver jewelry, never wore a mask, never wore gloves, and was right over the Bunsen burner and what's in silver, thallium and mercury. So she had 3,000 times the amount that would kill a person in that amount of iron.
Wow. Jeez.
I've had the same thing in many other analysis of my vomit and my my feces, and the diarrhea, that is, when it occurred. Probably have done about over 100 tests on those various compounds. And the chemotherapy, I had antifreeze. You know, we used antifreeze for a while as a chemotherapy.
Yep.
1968, we outlawed it the next year because it was too dangerous and too deadly. And that's what they gave me. I vomited as much as 2 weeks ago.
Right.
It's been 42 years since I had it, the AZT.
So you're saying you're still detoxifying these things in your system now?
Yes. Well, when they gave me they irradiated me, they caused a huge ball of scar tissue, which was non-malignant. It's a tumor, and it's been resting just outside the stomach because they committed the surgery, and that's where the tumor developed, all the way from the stomach lining out to my skin at my sternum. So each year it gradually goes down, and when it goes down a lot, I will usually be in excruciating back pain where the center of the radiation bolt was, and all along that large swelling in there, that benign tumor. Now it was about the size of my fist, up down to about the size of 4 beans.
Yeah.
And each year I have to go through it.
So massive improvement. So, obviously, when we talk about raw food, most people assume that we mean, raw vegetables. But that's not what we mean. We mean raw meat. So can you talk a little bit about, why raw meat?
Well, the reason for raw meat is that you have to take a look at your animal structure, gastronomical physiology. A lot of vegetarians claim that we have teeth for chewing vegetation. It's just the opposite of what we have. We have 90% cutting teeth and only 10% grinding teeth. And all of our bacteria in the mouth, or 98% of the 95 to 98% of that bacteria is putrefactive bacteria. Putrefactive bacteria digest animal tissue, whether it's milk or meat or some other form of animal tissue. That's what we digest. When the food moves down into the stomach, what do we have? Hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid is designed for animal products again, meats, dairy. And then the bacteria that is introduced also into the stomach and duodenum, the lower part of the duodenum. We have one stomach, almost 2 chambers. The lower part is usually called the duodenum, and it is full of 90% putrefactive bacteria to digest animal products again. all throughout the intestines, the small and the large intestines are the same. 92 to 95% of all the gastronomical bacteria in your intestines that digest food is putrefactive.
So let me ask you this. There are Paleolithic dieters out there who would say from an evolutionary standpoint, we still ate a mixture of cooked and raw food, or at least we definitely ate some cooked food. Do you have any evidence to suggest that we only ate raw food?
Well, I think that probably for, you know, millions of years we did. Maybe in the last 20,000, maybe periodically here and there they cooked. But most of these people who do all that theorizing have no clue what it's like to live outdoors. I lived outdoors for 3 years off of a bicycle, all the way from Yucatan, Mexico, all the way up to Alaska. I lived with four Indian tribes. And let me tell you, when you live outdoors and you have to make a fire every time, it's not worth it.
Right.
If it's raining, you certainly can't do it. If it's windy, you certainly can't do it. 90% of the time, if you're living outdoors, in strenuous environment like it is living outdoors, unless you're in the tropics, it's very difficult to make fire.
Okay.
And it's very inconvenient. Also, you have to consider that our intestinal tract is 2.5 times smaller than any other herbivore. Herbivores eat vegetation, leaves, stalks, and roots. And they have 60,000 times more enzymes to disassemble the cellulose molecule to get the fats and the protein. Even if you look at the feces of an herbivore, whether it's a cow, goat, or whatever, you'll see that a lot of the fiber still is not digested. And it takes them 2 days. They have 48 hours to digest that food. Ours passes through in 24 hours.
Yep.
So we're not equipped to be herbivores. We're not equipped to digest and be thriving with vegetation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I tried it for 6.5 years, and it just didn't work.
Okay, well, just focusing more on the cooking side of things. Do you have any theories or anything that you found that suggest why we, the way I understand it is that, you know, raw food eating, in what you teach, raw food, tell me if this is wrong, that raw food eating is more nutritious than cooking your food. Have you found anything that says why we actually started cooking our food if eating raw is more healthy?
Well, living outdoors and when you're carrying food, let's say you've got a dead animal, the odor gets pretty strong. And if you're not very used to it, or you just don't like the odor constantly, a lot of people would cook their food for that reason.
Right.
Just because of the odors. It also kept a lot of animals away.
Cooking it?
The fire process and cooking, yes. So yeah. A lot of animals wouldn't eat the cooked meat that they would eat the raw meat.
Okay. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of listeners out there who have probably seen that clip where you're on that show in the States. It's called The Doctors. And you eat the raw chicken. One of the questions a lot of people have been asking me is, how would you answer this question? Doesn't raw chicken and raw meat give you food poisoning?
No, never. The only thing that can give you food poison are chemicals, additives in food. Even if you have high meat, and I lived with several tribes that eat high meat, and high meat means that you let it decay, that you let it get very stinky, that you let the bacteria in the meat and in nature pre-digest it for you. The Turks will even take gangrene, and we're told gangrene's awful, and they'll coat a whole side or a whole beef with this gangrene, go back 3 or 4 days later, scrape off the outer inch, and then you've got gangrene bacteria throughout it, which softens the meat. It tenderizes it because in our intestines, 80 to 90% of digestion is bacterial. Only 10 to 20% is acidic enzyme activity like digestive juices, like hydrochloric acid. The bacteria eats the food, its byproducts, its secretions, whether it's urine or feces of that bacteria, is our food. That's how we eat. And the medical profession and, of course, the food industry definitely don't want you to realize that or take that to mind, because then you'll no longer be afraid of bacteria. What you will be afraid of is the real things that cause disease, which is industrial pollution, additives to food. That's what causes poison. So you'll see a doctor that will analyze for a particular kind of bacteria if you have vomit and diarrhea. You're always going to have bacteria because you have one human gene to every 150 bacterial genes. You're always going to find bacteria everywhere. We're 150% bacteria and 1% human.
Right. So let me get your take on, obviously supermarket meats are completely different to, you know, obviously grown meats. Can you comment on supermarket meats and, you know, how, I guess, cows are fed grains when they're, you know, obviously meant to feed grass, and, you know, what they're doing to chickens and pigs and all these type of things? Would you ever eat supermarket meat raw?
Only when I had to, when I had nothing else. And it's not frequently that I do that.
Yeah,
they give them hormones, antibiotics, and mostly, unless they're grass-fed animals, 90% of what they're fed are byproducts from making cereals and other foods. They feed them chemically processed, completely inundated with over 60,000 chemicals. That's what they feed 90% of the animals out there.
So,
now all animals eat raw except for humans.
Yeah, in that case, would you ever consider? Because obviously, the animals from the supermarket. Would you ever advise someone to, cook supermarket products because of the fact that they're not fit? If they're going to eat supermarket products, it would be advisable to cook supermarket products.
Well, because I've never done it on a, I've never experimented with eating cooked meat from the supermarket. I couldn't tell you firsthand knowledge. However, I've done chemical analysis on them, and the amount of poisons that are released from the cooking process is 5 times that of what we eat raw.
So I guess in a nutshell, what you're saying is that it's always better to eat raw.
It's always better to eat raw, and also if you're going to eat cooked, you're still better to eat organic.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, yeah. Definitely get it from the local farmer and get all organic. You eat your meats raw. Every time I talk about raw food to people, they assume I mean vegetables. Now, vegetables contain natural pesticides known as lectins. Are lectins, say, in broccoli an issue? And in fact, wouldn't it make, what's your take on, eating vegetables raw? And is the lectins a problem?
Well, as I said, I don't eat vegetation.
Oh, you don't eat any vegetation at all?
No, I do not eat any vegetation at all.
Okay.
Well, once in a while, I eat a little bit of raw sugar cane. Maybe once in a while, a tiny bit of carrot, but that's maybe once a year. And I'm talking about a tablespoon. But I juice my vegetables.
You juice them?
We don't digest more. We only digest 2% of vegetables. And that should be the juice. So that's what I do. I juice my vegetables.
Right. How do you go about juicing when you're outdoors? It's going to be very hard to... how do you go about juicing when you're out? Because you said you spend a lot of time outdoors.
Yes. Well, I'll chew the vegetables and spit out the pulp, swallow the juice.
Righty. So that's how you solve that one. Is there any, for the listeners out there, hard and fast rules about eating raw? Is there any certain preparations that you think they should do?
I say go eat what your body digests best gastronomically, and of course that's raw dairy, raw meats, raw vegetable juices, raw fruit if you're going to eat them, and eat very small amounts of those other things, and large amounts of meat, dairy, and eggs. Eggs are probably the easiest to eat. Rules are, don't mix vegetable juice with any of the other foods. Maybe a little bit of raw cream or a little raw milk. The vegetable juice will alkalinize the stomach, digestive juices and intestinal juices, so that you won't digest any protein that accompanies the alcohol.
Righty. So just
best have vegetable juices and fruits alone, or fruits with, you can have fruits with milk or with cheese or with cream,
yeah,
butter, you, things like that.
You brought up a very good topic there about alkalinity and acidic. Can you give us what you believe to be true with the whole alkaline being acidic? Because obviously you're talking about not eating any vegetables, and a lot of people will turn around and say, well, won't that make you very highly acidic because you're eating all this meat? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that for our listeners?
Well, normally the tribes that I live in who are raw meat eaters, there's three in Africa. Fulani and the Maasai. They each eat a little differently. The Fulani eat mainly 90% dairy. The Samburu and Maasai are very close to about 60% of the anywhere from 35 to 60% of the 35. The rest is dairy. And they're all the strongest, healthiest tribes in the world. The Eskimo eats only meats, doesn't eat any dairy, and mostly raw. The Inuit, the ones that still live in the Inuit, they still eat mainly meat, no dairy, no vegetables. They chew on some berries in the summertime, like blueberries, wild blueberries, and then grizzly berries. And there's no real rule involved in all of that. And the acidity in all of those tribes are acid. They have a 5-5 blood, they have a 5-5 urine, and they have an average of 5-5 feces and saliva. So it's all supposed to be acidic. These are the healthiest tribes that have absolutely no disease, not even dental care. Now, can you imagine going through life to over 140 years old and having no tooth decay? I think that's pretty amazing.
Right.
So the acidity thing, now, because I was raised in an industrial society with lots of processed foods and additives, my body is over-acidic. So I do have vegetable juices and a little fruit to add a little alkalinity to that. All of the people about your body has to be alkaline, and the blood has to be alkaline, your digestive tract has to be alkaline, are not even observing the gastronomical history and makeup of the human. They're just theorizing, oh, it should be. It has nothing to do with reality.
Right.
Most of the people that I see on high alkaline diets with disease get worse, not better.
Right.
I put them on, high acidic diets like this, of course, with the vegetable juice, which is alkalinizing, to counterbalance the industrial pollution, which is acidic, the wrong acidity, and they get healthy very quickly. I mean, that's, I'd say, 85 to 86% of people who go on my primal diet get well quickly.
Hey, I'm
just take time.
Would you just be able to just speak up just a tiny bit? Because it is just breaking up a little bit. What have I got in the last part of what you said? And it was really fantastic what you said. I guess the take-home message is people who advocate an alkaline diet are missing the point that we were never meant to be alkalinic. We were actually meant to be acidic. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And that the toxic acidity that is in the human body is from industrial pollution. It's not a natural bacterial or animal acidity.
Right. That's some good points. Okay, so let's just switch gears. What do you think of the role of supplements that they play in a healthy diet?
Well, supplements are industrial pollution. Whether you're taking it from a natural substance or whether you're mining it from the earth or you're making it in a chemistry lab, you have to use heat or solvents to separate things. So you take corn. and you want the vitamin E from it, and you want the, let's say, vitamin A from it. And a lot of that goes on. What does a laboratory do? Somebody goes to a laboratory first and says, I want to make a natural vitamin. I want to make vitamin A and vitamin E. How can you make it for me? The laboratory wants the business. And they say, absolutely, we can make you a natural vitamin A and vitamin E. So they have to grow the corn to do it. And if they go through that process, a bottle of, let's say, 1,000 units of vitamin E, or one, let's say, about five drops, will cost you $1,000 to make. So what the laboratory does, it goes to General Foods, buys their corn mesh, all the byproduct of making, their cereals, which have been processed with chemicals and heat and all kinds of things. That laboratory box does not use any more chemicals except for a natural one, and that is kerosene. Kerosene is natural, but would you drink it?
No.
No. It's a poison, even though it's natural. Arsenic is a poison. It is natural, but it's a poison. You don't eat those things in concentrations because they're poisonous in concentrations. So they use this kerosene derivative to extract the nutrients. What do you have? Would you take a peach or an almond, any food, soak it in kerosene for 20 to 30 minutes, rinse it off and eat it, and think that you're not going to have kerosene that's eating its way into the tissue.
Right. So you're saying that the biggest problem with
all supplements are made chemically. And once they're isolated, they're no longer the same vitamin anymore. They have no relationship.
Right. And about dehydrated things like, say, for example, green powder, which has been dehydrated and then mixed. Do you still see a problem with those things like that?
It's you can't digest it. Give it to a cow or a horse or a pig, or a goat. They could digest something dried like that. Eat dried grass all the time.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this question. Now, I'm a guy, as a lot of the listeners out there, they want to achieve optimal body composition in obviously as short time as possible, okay? So, training for the sake of training, many of the listeners will be on the call who fit into that category. We want to look strong, we want to be strong, and we want to be lean. What raw foods and what things could they do that could benefit them today?
Well, you can go to Scott Mueller's website right here in Australia. He's in Sydney.
What was his name?
He's on the Primal Diet.
Scott
Wheeler. Scott Wheeler.
Wheeler.
W-H-E-E-L-E-R. Scott Wheeler. And he's been on the diet for about 3 years, and you should see how ripped and strong and big his muscles are. They're huge. I've had people go... I remember a 61-year-old man who came to me, and he'd been skinny all of his life. And every time he tried to work out, he'd get sick. So he went on the diet. He was on the diet for about a year. And he said, oh, can I bodybuild on this diet? And I said, yeah, just eat lots of butter with your meat. He was about 6'1". So he was eating 2 pounds of meat a day with what I call the... lubrication moisturizing formula in my book, which is a combination of raw butter, a little bit of raw honey, a little bit of raw lemon juice, and just blend that all together. So it's butter, lemon juice, and honey, basically is all it is. And you blend that together, and an egg, one or two eggs in it, raw eggs. So you blend that all together, tastes like a lemon meringue drink. And you have that with your meat, like, say, a cup of it or a half a cup with, depending upon your size, a half pound to a whole pound of meat sliced daily.
So how many...
Put on 4 inches on his arms and about 6 inches on his waist. On his chest.
Right. So how much butter would someone use in that?
That would be about probably 8 to 16 tablespoons daily.
8 to 16 tablespoons?
Correct.
And how much honey?
Oh, about, it depends if you like it sweet, if it digests better with the honey, anywhere from a half a tablespoon to a whole tablespoon.
Okay, all righty.
And the lemon about anywhere from, you know, a half a tablespoon to a whole tablespoon of lemon juice. And 1, 2, 3 eggs.
All right. And how many times a day would you have that drink?
Twice daily. If you're having, if you want to build quickly, muscle quickly, you need 2 meat eats daily.
Two daily. All righty. And question, another question.
You have one of those 2 meat eats, yeah.
Did you want to finish what you were saying?
Well, what I was going to say was you have some of that lubrication formula with each meat meal. That way you don't burn up your meat in fuel. The fat will be there to burn.
Right.
A lot of people have trouble building muscles because they stay on a fat-free diet, and the body keeps turning the protein into pyruvate or an acetate to burn as fuel.
Yeah.
On this diet, people build quickly and fully.
So I have a question from a Facebook question, actually. Are there any things that you should not eat raw, and why? Apart from the vegetables,
well,
I guess.
Poison mushrooms, I'm going to suggest that nobody eats poison mushrooms.
Of course.
You know, I did that once, and it took me about 11 years to recover.
Jeez.
Even on a full diet. But by doing that, because I did that, at that time, you know, I was eating raw meat, 3 raw meat meals a week. Still a lot of raw dairy. But after the poison mushroom, a very slow progression getting well at the age of about 34, it happened. And a year and a half of very slow progress of recovering from it. I began eating raw meat twice daily. Then I quickly got, you know, started moving quickly through my symptoms of poisoning, which was almost total destruction of my red blood cells and liver. So it was a rough road coming back. But with all the raw meat, I was able to do it. Now, a lot of people will say, what about brain flukes? That's what everybody says. Anytime they hear, you know, the raw meat business, they say, what about parasites? What about brain flukes?
What are brain flukes?
Brain parasites.
Okay. Fluke. Yep.
So there's no anywhere in literature, anywhere in science, actual experiments that showed studying anybody who ate raw meat. So this whole fiction from the medical profession is myth. It's not truth. I consider my body. I had a vagotomy when I had the stomach cancer. They severed all the vagus nerves to my stomach so I would never again secrete hydrochloric acid to digest protein properly. So they told me that I would be in danger of death from eating anything raw. Anything raw. But that's all I've eaten for 42 years.
Yeah.
And I've never been sick from it. I've been sick only from the industrial chemicals that are invaded in my body that take, according to Howell and Pottinger, 40 years to remove.
Jeez.
So all right. I've still got about 10 years to go.
Okay, let me ask you about this question. Now, I think we can all agree that iodized salt has obviously very, very limited value in everyone's diet. However, you know, there's a bit of controversy around colored salt or Celtic sea salt. Now, I heard you say on another podcast that sodium acts like an explosive in the cell, and all salt, not just the iodized salt, should be avoided. Can you elaborate on this?
Well, you just spelled it out very well. When you isolate sodium, it is an explosive. It's more explosive than nitroglycerin. The only reason they haven't made it into a weapon is because it's more volatile than nitroglycerin. 1.5 degree temperature change can set off sodium, isolated sodium.
Is that any form like
a block of sodium crystal as big as a football is more powerful than an atomic bomb.
In what way? Because can you just explain that a little bit more? Because I guess there'll be a few listeners listening to this saying a block of, like, they probably won't get it in terms of you saying a block of salt the size of a football, because a lot of people would probably be looking at their salt shaker right now and saying, this is more powerful than an atomic bomb. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, you've got iodine with it, or potassium. You've got some other element with it that neutralizes its volatility. But when you go in, when it goes into the body, because it's in rock form, the body separates the iodine from the sodium and the potassium from the sodium, whatever they've used to bind with the sodium. So it happens within the body.
Right.
Let's, if you go online and you put YouTube frog legs salt, you'll come up with a video that show, and they have one with pepper also. And this was because of what I, you know, I said about salt. So these guys are going to show me and show the story differently. So they took frog legs that were, you know, still a day old, and dead a day. They sprinkled salt on them within a minute or sort of like 50 seconds or 8 seconds. These legs start jumping. And I'm jumping, spasming because of the salt. They do the same thing with pepper, and one spasm, and that was it. Now, you taste pepper. It's very hot and spicy. It can burn your mouth. Yet, when they put it on raw tissue, it did not cause but one spasm. When they put the salt on, and let me tell you, they put very little salt compared to the pepper, and these... The time span of pulsations or spasms in these frog legs, they show for about 1 minute.
Wow.
The actual time that it spasmed was 9 minutes.
So you're saying they cut off the legs, and they were a day old, the legs, and then they did it?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
So the animal's dead. The animal's dead for a whole day.
Jeez.
And still, the salt did that.
Now,
I was
having this conversation about salt with a friend, and one of the things I guess they highlighted was that animals do go out of their way in nature to find salts. How would you respond to that?
I would say that is a myth. I've lived in nature, you know, for many, many years, completely in nature for 3 years. I've lived with every animal you can imagine, including alligators, and none of them go for salt.
None of them go for
salt. Only domesticated animals in domesticated environments like dairy farms go for salt because they're fed so many processed foods. They start losing sodium and other minerals. And if it were a mineral block that they were licking, if it were dolomite, they'd be going for dolomite. But farmers who are making dairy and, you know, fatty cows, they want them to hydrate and build with a lot of water. So, of course, we're going to give them a salt block.
Right.
Salt makes them retain more water. There's going to be more milk. There's going to be more water in the muscles, and then you can sell it for a higher price.
Right.
In nature, you do not find it.
No, you don't.
Well,
yeah.
I have to... I thought there was one animal that wasn't going for the salt, but there were monkeys that were washing the potatoes that they were eating in salt. That's the only time that I've seen them eating additional salt.
Righty. All right, well, let's switch gears. And
we're talking land animals, of course. It's all water animals are entirely different.
Yeah, certainly. I was going to ask you about butter. I eat a lot of butter. However, when I flip through your book, The Primal Diet, it makes me go, whoa, that's a lot of butter. Obviously, we spoke before about 8 to 16 tablespoons of butter. I love butter, and I definitely promote it as a wonder food. However, in your words, could you teach the listener why butter is so important and why it is such a wonder food?
Well, you have to understand that fats bind with poison. Fats help you digest and make muscles. Fats are responsible for 80% of your energy level. If you want to take a look at the strength and durability of anybody, you look at your wrestlers. Are they skinny? Absolutely not. Your bodybuilders? Yeah. And how strong are they? You won't see a bodybuilder going out there and lifting 600-700 pounds. They can't do it. It takes fat to do that. So considering all the need for fat that we have, consider what is the most easily digestible and what is the most helpful and what produces the best results of what I want. And butter all around does it. The only thing that butter does not take care of completely is the brain and nervous system. And then the raw milk takes care of that, the raw cream. The raw butter is absolutely superior to any fat in the world for getting you healthy quickly, for getting you strong, for giving you stamina, for anything. It's easiest, most easily digestible.
In today's society, a lot of people find it hard to get things like raw milk and raw cream. What else would be a good alternative to look after the brain if butter's not so good?
Well, you're not going to find anything comparable, anywhere near comparable. When I can't get those, I eat coconut cream. I'll juice the meat of the coconut, get the coconut cream. But I'll also eat some of that coconut along with it. But that's about the only thing you're going to get near it. Of course, any animal fat, you need fat on an animal, a healthy animal, is good fat.
Is there such thing as, I guess, too much butter?
Well, certainly. I've seen people, get very, very large and very big quickly and, get fatigued because they're so big. When you get to a point where you can't function as easily, then I would say time to reduce. Still continue consuming butter, but just make it less. Now, I have a friend who's a martial artist and a master and has a martial arts school, and he doesn't drink water like I suggest, and everybody told him he had to, and he eats a tremendous amount of the butter. He was a very small person before he went on the diet, muscle-wise and bone-wise. And then when he went on the diet, he's like, 5'10", 5'11". And when he went on the diet, he was about 145 pounds. That's pretty thin. Now he's up to about 200 and works out better than he's ever worked out. He said it took him a little exercise, time in exercising, to get used to the added weight, but his strength is 5 times what it was before. His muscle density is twice what it was.
Cool.
And he eats a ton of butter.
You just touched on something there that maybe you could explain a little bit more. You said you tell people not to drink water.
Yeah. Water is, like salt, it's a problem. It will cause problems in the body. It's a solvent. If you look in an archaeological book, the first thing under solvent, which is something that dissolves things, is rain, is water. It drops in the sky, it dissolves rock and plants eat. So when we put it into our body, it's completely nutrient deficient. It dissolves and it leaches. You don't want that happening in your body much. With real water is okay. But a lot of water is not okay. You get H2O from everything. Like I'll drink 2 quarts of milk a day. That's where I get my water. I drink maybe a cup of water a month.
Wow. That's it. The rest of the time you drink
milk. 90% of all fruits, 92 to 90% is all water. Meat is 55% water, minimum. 55% water. Then your milk is like 86% water. So every raw food you consume has all of that water in it, which is plenty to take care of the body. Plus, it's all nutrient bound. The key is nutrient bound. Plain water out there is not nutrient bound.
Right.
What it does is dissolve and leach in your body.
Right.
And all this hype and myth about dehydration, and you got to drink all this water, it is not correct. It deteriorates your body, will age you.
But with that said, you did touch on before that there's a lot of toxins out there and water can be used as a solvent. So couldn't one argue that obviously because there are a lot of environmental toxins in our everyday world today, that using or drinking water has helped flushing out those toxins?
Yes, it will. But like I say, most of your foods are already water. However, I will drink, let's say I'm going to a detoxification, like last week, some of that old chemotherapy came up, and I vomited for 24 hours. Guess what was in it?
What?
AGT. AGT and the iodine that they use in the radiation process.
Sorry, what did you say was in it?
42 years ago. So what I did, just started detoxifying. My body cleans it every year. Once a year, it will start cleaning that area from 42 years ago. So whenever I go through that, I will drink a little water, like I was having a half a cup of water a day for 5 days.
Right.
To help dissolve and neutralize those poisons. Of course, I ate a tremendous amount of cheese to absorb the poisons, and a lot of milk to provide the minerals to bind with those poisons, as well as the compound of water to fractionate it.
So what would the average day in the life and average diet, what's the average food that you would eat in a day?
Well, I'm a little different because I travel a lot and I've been on the diet a long time and I'm not as toxic as many people. But like I put out in my recipe book, The Recipe for Living Without Disease, I put in there, start your day off with a little cheese to absorb the poisons, vegetable juice that you dump during the night, vegetable juice to alkalinize some of that chemical toxicity throughout the night, and then about 30, 40 minutes later, you have a meat meal with some raw eggs. Something that's low in carbohydrates, so your body makes your glycogen from a protein rather than a carbohydrate. High carbohydrates cause a lot of AGEs, which are advanced glycation end products. And those store in a body at a rate of anywhere from 70 to 90%, according to Columbia University. And that's part of the aging process. A lot of cancer is involved in those advanced glycation end products. And we store them at a rate of 70 to 90%, even if you're healthy, 70 to 80%. So those poisons growing up in the body are not good. And you need to make them from raw food. So you need to lower the amount of carbohydrates consumed. And if you start the day off by eating mainly meat and dairy, eggs, you give your body a lot of protein and fats, and it will make the glycogen from a pyruvate, protein sugar, that does not store. Only the carbohydrate glycogen byproducts store. So your brain is cleaner, you think better, you have more clarity, more everything. So you start your day off eating the meat. You know, of course you have some cheese, lower poison, 10 minutes after that, or right away, vegetable juice, which is mainly cucumber and celery, a little bit of carrots, a little bit of carbohydrate. And then about 35, 40 minutes, an hour after that, have a meat meal with your butter. And then, you know, after that, maybe a milkshake you sip throughout the day. And then maybe have a fruit meal in the afternoon with some fat, either avocado or coconut cream, a cheese, some kind of fat. Always have your high carbohydrate or, you know, sweet and nasty fruit with a fat to slow it down in the body. Then in the evening, another meat meal with some butter and then maybe a half a cup of milk before you go to sleep, and then maybe an egg or two during the night, so your body isn't eating from protein. And for them, 5 hours, your body's blood bottoms out on protein, you know, going to start eating itself, which means it usually eats the red blood cells. So red blood cells become cannibalistic and eat red blood cells. So that's why a lot of people will wake up in the morning after 8 to 10 hours and be fatigued and tired because they're anemic. They've lost 2 to 4 red tablespoons of red blood cells because they've slept without eating, they've gone without eating for 5 hours. I recommend if people need 8 hours of sleep, they get an alarm for 3 to 5 hours after they go to sleep, get up and eat, drink a half a cup of salt, suck a raw egg, or either, you know, half a cup of meat,
so you recommend,
a little bit of butter, and get back to sleep.
You recommend interrupting people's sleep?
Absolutely.
But won't that...
it works.
That will harm a number of things in terms of obviously the rapid eye movement, people's deep sleep, the production of melatonin, the production and resetting neurotransmitters in the brain.
I'm not saying reduce sleep. I'm saying eat. Can eat and go back to sleep.
But if you wake up, I mean, anything now is classified as waking up for more than 3 seconds is classified as interrupted sleep. So waking up in the middle of the night is definitely interrupting sleep patterns.
Well, let me tell you, if you hear from the medical profession, do the opposite, you'll be right. 99% of the time. I say that repeatedly. The medical profession makes no money unless you're sick. The medical profession is run completely by the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry writes the medical procedures, which are all geared toward medication. And they're not geared toward healing you. They're geared toward making you take more medication.
Oh, I can agree with that, absolutely. Okay. However, the sleep recommendation, that's where I guess I draw the line and would have to say, you know, agree to disagree. Because, I mean, you know, there are a lot of factors in sleep, your body.
Let me give you an example. I had a young man who had been a vegetarian for about 16, 17 years. He was probably 46 when he came to me. He was very skinny, had osteoporosis. He had scoliosis from it, almost a hunchback at this time. Almost no muscle tissue whatsoever. Very weak, and he was a scientist. 2 years on the diet. Looks all buffed up, strong, straight standing, can work, you know, lots of hours. But it always used to take him many hours after the day started to get the energy up. And, you know, he came to me after 2 years on it and said, listen, you know, it's 10 or noon before I have any energy. Then I'm great. He said, before then, I said, are you doing what I said? Are you waking in the night and having something so you're not going 5 hours without eating? He said, gave me the same arguments you gave me, the melatonin and everything. And I said, just try it. Do this one night, John. Go do it. Try it. The next morning, he woke, and he had all the energy in the world. Just that one change.
Okay, well, yeah, that's good, but I guess the thing that I would, you know, still not sold on, the fact that he was a vegetarian, so obviously his red blood cell count, as you said, would be lower than someone who had been eating meat their whole life. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely tools for the tool belt, but, yeah, I guess I'm not as absolute as that. But anyway, it doesn't matter. We can digress and, you know, on that issue. But one thing that I know you are an expert on is honey. You know, can you talk a little bit about honey? I remember reading in your book you spoke about honey not heating over 160 degrees Celsius because it destroys the honey.
No, 93 degrees for honey.
Yeah, but, oh, sorry, yep, 93 degrees for honey. Now, is Maluka honey the same thing, or is that unheated? Is Maluka honey better, is it worse, or should people just be opting for the raw honey?
Depends on the beekeeper. Most beekeepers heat their honey to make it pour fast so they can bottle more quicker and sell it. They don't have to put as much time in. 93 degrees is what the bees, when they collect the honey, they swallow it. I mean, they collect the nectar. They swallow it. That process of swallowing the nectar, pre-digesting it, may produce an insulin-like substance, which allows for predigestion of the sugars. So it converts those sugars into more active enzymes than sugars. So when you heat the honey above 93 degrees, it starts breaking down that insulin-like substance. And then it's all sugar again.
And that's the same truth for Maluka honey? Maluka honey still can be heated?
Absolutely.
And what about the argument, I guess, with Maluka honey? I was speaking to a beekeeper the other day, actually, and he said that they have to slightly heat Maluka honey because otherwise they can't pour it. Is that...
That's what I said.
Yeah.
They can pour it, it's just very slow.
Right. Before
they
we wrap...
Spend the time doing it.
Sorry?
They don't want to spend the time doing that.
Yeah, correct. Before we wrap up today, are there any final thoughts or words of wisdom?
Yes, anything the medical profession says, do the opposite 99% of the time, you'll be right and healthy.
I like that. All right, and where can the listeners find out more about you?
Well, they can go to a website called We Want to Live. We Want Live are all spelled out. The 2TO is really the numeral 2, so it's We Want spelled out. The numeral 2, livespelledout.com. And I have two books there that can be purchased. I also have a DVD lecture set, which are all of what you heard today, plus 4 hours more material, and how to do the diet, basically, and how to make it work. And then I have a newsletter that they can subscribe to, everyone can subscribe to, and get more information. And also there's a DVD of recipes, making raw food, final diet recipe, that will be out in about a month.
Awesome. Awesome stuff. Thank you so much for today, so much for your time, and thank you so much for your words of wisdom. It's been much appreciated. I'm sure people will get a lot of insight into this, and I'm sure people will definitely start making changes in terms of adding butter. I keep telling my listeners, you know, to add butter. And jumping on the raw honey, because they're definitely big changes that can, you know, make a big difference. So thank you again for today, and we wish you all the best. I'll put some of your links up on my website and when I post up this podcast, and make sure you check out Adonis's book. So thanks for today.
Okay, and I hope to see you in November when I'm in Australia.
Absolutely. Take care, Adonis.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.